Okay, so yes, this is actually the second part of a two-part series, but you can get this part without having been here for the first. It was spurred by this saga of the Panama Papers and the law firm down in Panama and the disclosure of the level of tax avoidance that was going on, that they were facilitating, whether it involved anything illegal or not, because as we talked about last time, tax avoidance is different from tax evasion, right? Tax evasion means I am liable to pay, and I just, don't. Tax avoidance means that I structure my business dealings in such a way that I avoid a tax hit. Now, you might say, well, if that's all I did, if that's what, if that's what tax avoidance is, what could be wrong with it? And the answer is that governments tend not to like tax avoidance. Even if you manage to structure your business dealings in such a way that you avoid a tax hit, the government may still get you, in essence. If you take a look at source number two, I'm going to come back to number one, but just as a way of introducing this point, this is from the Income Tax Act. There are still sheets in the middle, where it says, where a transaction is an avoidance transaction, the tax consequences to a person shall be determined as is reasonable in the circumstances in order to deny a tax benefit that but for this section would result directly or indirectly from that transaction or from a series of transactions that includes that transaction. So to translate that into English, what it's saying is we have a law that says that if you engage in a transaction, a sale, a gift, whatever it is, as a means of avoiding a tax hit, and there is no other benefit to it, that's what this transaction is, and that's what the law goes on to say, if the sole purpose is to avoid taxation, then this law says we are going to deny you whatever tax benefit you would have achieved by engaging in that sale, gift, or whatever it is. There's something else called fraudulent conveyance in terms of inheritances and estate issues, but the fundamental idea is that if a person says, I'm going to sell something to somebody, give something to somebody, move something to a certain location, and the only rationale for doing so is so that I am able to avoid a tax hit, the government is going to come in and say, you get the same tax hit regardless. You're not getting around the tax burden. And so the questions that I wanted to address were, first, what we dealt with for the most part last time, what is an ethical taxation system from a Jewish perspective? What is a good way for society to determine its taxes? And then the second question, which is the focus today, is the question of tax avoidance from a Jewish perspective. We have all sorts of taxes within Judaism, as we discussed last time. And the question is, if somebody arranges his business such that he avoids those taxes, has he done anything wrong from a Jewish perspective? The question that I mentioned last time that I'm not addressing is the question of trusting the government to use my tax money wisely. In other words, there are different reasons why people will avoid the taxes. So what I'm not going to discuss is the guy who says, I want to support all sorts of institutions and causes within the community. I just think the government wastes a lot of the money. So what I'm going to do is I'll avoid the tax and I'll pay into society some other way. I'm going to hire people to fill the potholes or whatever, whatever idea. I'm going to sponsor a hospital or whatever the person decides to do. So that's beyond the scope of our discussion, although the question of when government uses it properly and improperly is a good one. So last time, when we talked about ethical taxation, we addressed the fundamental question of Canada's progressive income tax. Because Canada does have, like many countries, a progressive income tax, meaning that the more you earn, not only the more you pay, but the higher the percentage that is taken of your income in order to pay it. So it's not just that there's a 10% or 20% or 50% tax and you earn less, you pay less. But actually, people at the lower end will pay 10% bracket, 18% bracket, whatever it is, and people at the higher end will pay at a higher percentage. And some have argued that you should study the Torah's text in order to figure out what Judaism wants the tax rates to be, but Adam Khodorov, who's a professor at University of Arizona, has written a few articles on taxation from a Jewish law perspective, and he points out that Judaism has more than one model. and that each of the models of taxation you find within Judaism actually has a different system, so that we have flat taxes. We have proportional income taxes. We have taxes that seem to be of a blend of different kinds. You can't really say this is the Jewish way to do it. So, for example, we talked about agricultural taxes, in which a certain percentage is supposed to be given to the priest, to the Kohen, right? That's a tax. Right, the truma, the 2%. You have another 10% that's supposed to go to the needy in most years, maaser ani. These are proportional. It's the same for everybody in terms of what you have to, of how much you have to give. And so you could argue that maybe that's a proportional income tax. However, you could also make the argument that it's not. You could actually design that and say that that's a progressive tax. I'm sorry, that's no. You could argue that it's not a model. I apologize, because there is an issue of the effective tax rate versus the rate that people are giving, by which we mean that since the tax that you pay goes to members of society, those members of society, once you subtract their gains from what they have to give, actually have a lower effective tax rate than everybody else who is simply giving it away. For me, the tax rate may be 10% when I give it to the needy. However, since the needy people are receiving, even as they also pay out, they're actually getting a different effective tax rate. It's not really the same for everybody, this system. I'm not going to reopen the entire hour of discussion or so that we had last time. But what I did want to emphasize, because there was a point that we didn't get to finish, is that what emerges from the two systems is that Canada's system, by which it designs the tax burden for society, is very community oriented, meaning that there is a desire to ensure that the burden is distributed equally within the community. You don't want people having to pay unjustly when you compare them with other people of similar standing, of similar place in society. That's a value within the Canadian system. The Jewish system is not like that at all. The Jewish system, as we discussed last time, is much more goal-oriented. It's, we need to raise X number of dollars in order to support the needy or the various causes within the community, and this is how we're going to do it. And if it means that you have to pay more than other people like you, so be it. That's just the way it works. It's ultimately about making sure the community gets what it needs to get. And what Khadarov points out that I think is fascinating is here in source number one. He says, the comparison of tithing and tax rules also reveals how a society's values can play a significant role in the development of the law. The federal tax rules are motivated to a large degree, he's dealing with American, but it translates for this, are motivated to a large degree by concerns over horizontal equity, the idea that similarly situated people ought to be treated the same. Such concerns play virtually no role in the development of the tithing law in Judaism. Instead, the rabbis are concerned that each individual fulfill his obligation to God, regardless of how others might be treated. The effect these different values have on the development of the law can best be seen by comparing the discussions concerning the accounting period rules and the propriety of deducting state sales taxes, which is the sentence you probably never thought you would read. But he's right. The way that you structure your tax system changes depending on what your values are. And to explain what he means, in terms of state sales tax, so the rule is, at least in the U.S., and I think here also, that you can deduct what you pay for state sales taxes from your income calculation when it comes to calculating your federal income tax. So in other words, I have a sum, that's my income, I have various deductions. One of the things I'm able to deduct is money that I paid out in state sales tax in the U.S. I'm assuming that where you have a provincial sales tax, you're able to do the same thing, but honestly, I give my papers to the accountant, then they tell me how much to pay. And that's really all I know about the way it works there. Can you do that here? Is there no...
It's fine, though. I think what he's actually talking about is it's not more of a deduction, than it's more of a... Both are calculated separately.
Yeah.
But suddenly the amount of state tax that you're paying does affect your federal tax, but it's not a one-to-one.
No, but he's not talking about state income taxes. He's talking about state sales tax. Yeah. Different issue. In other words, right. Well, it's not the harmonized. It's where you would have let me not go into things that other people. Yeah. Right. When you had a provincial sales tax in the U.S., different states have different sales taxes. Right. Some states don't have any. Other states have percentages of 7%, 11%, and even more. So the point that he's making is that in the U.S., the rule is that state sales tax can be deducted from your income before calculating the federal tax hit. So originally, they only did what Jonathan was talking about. They just deducted the state income tax. So if I paid a certain amount to the state, then there was a deduction that came off of my income when it came to the federal. However, that was seen to be unfair to some residents, because some residents don't have a state income tax, and instead have a higher state sales tax. Right, the state needs to make its money. Let's pretend for the moment, this isn't true, but let's pretend for the moment that Pennsylvania didn't have a state sales tax. So what they might do is say, in that case, we're going to raise what you're paying in income tax. Another state, let's say Delaware, doesn't have a state income tax. They raise the state sales tax. So the result is that when you didn't deduct the state sales tax, what would end up happening was people complained and said, well, I live in a state where they don't have an income tax, but they have a very high sales tax. So other people are benefiting because they can deduct their state income tax. I can't deduct it because for me it's coming out of a sales tax. I want that deducted too. And they in fact changed the rules in the U.S. that both taxes are deducted in one form or another. It's to make everybody pay equally. That's his point. In the Jewish system of maaser ksafim, of giving the 10% to the needy, 10% of income, or the truma maaser and so on, the agricultural tithes, or the half shekel and so on, we don't discuss the question of deducting in order to make sure that everybody deducts equally. There is a concept of deducting your income tax from your income before valuing what you're supposed to give to tzedakah. That's a separate question. But there's no discussion at all of deducting sales tax and equalizing things across society. Yes, Morris?
How do they figure out the taxes and the tithes there when we read in the parsha on the tithes? How do they figure out which tax, how much of a tax did they charge?
So the way it... Right,
or is there any tax that is imposed?
Oh, so there are a load of taxes. And one of the things that we spent time on last time was noting that your marginal tax rate biblically is actually pretty high. Meaning we know there's roughly 2% for Truma that goes to the Kohen. Then there's an additional 10% that goes to the Levite. There's another 10% which in some years goes to the poor, and in some years you take it to Jerusalem and eat it there. There are the first fruits, which is a little bit more of a vague number than there is for the others. There are various gleanings. Like there are plenty of taxes, and yes, they all have to be taken into consideration. Not just produce either. There's from cattle that are born in a given year. There's another tax. This separate from the fact that in Talmudic times, communities levied taxes for communal needs. So defense, for example, that would be levied on the citizens of the community. And there's a lot of discussion as to whether you levy it based on people's assets. We're protecting your assets, therefore if you have more assets, you have to pay more, or whether it's based on people's lives. In other words, everybody is all the same. Everybody is the same. So each person is going to have to pay a certain amount because her life is being protected. The one thing that you're pointing out, I think, is very important to realize, we did say it last time also, is that the Jewish system is much like the system that you see today in the sense that it's self-driven. You're responsible to calculate your income, figure out what to pay, and pay it. The government may swoop in at some point and check on you. But fundamentally, it's not the government's responsibility to come to you and say, you made X, now you have to pay this amount. It's your responsibility to actually do the calculation on your own and to get it right. So that's one example of this business with the sales tax is one example of a different value. The other example that I'll mention very quickly is that of the flexible accounting period. Meaning, in the secular system, we want to make sure that people of similar circumstances pay similar amounts. So what you do, the challenge that you come into, is that if you're going to create a fixed accounting period in which people are all going to have to account over the same period of time, is that you could have some people who earn all their money in one lump sum, And you have other people whose income comes in larger amounts at different times during the year. And you're going to end up, therefore, taxing them differently based on the fixed accounting period. And that is potentially unfair. And so the secular system allows for people to adjust their accounting periods and net at different times in order to compensate for that. In the Jewish system, we specifically don't want people to adjust their accounting period in order to minimize the burden on themselves, because that will minimize what they're going to provide for the needy and for the community. We don't want you to adjust it so that you use your losses to offset your income. So that the rabbis actually recommended even shortening the accounting periods in order to minimize the way that people would be able to play with it. So that's just wrapping up a note from last time that I thought was interesting. But the main topic right now is the tax avoidance issue. So we saw already from source number two, the Income Tax Act, that the Canadian law does not like transactions that are executed only for the sake of avoiding taxes. How will Judaism feel about this? Lest you think tax avoidance is a new topic, the answer is it is a very old topic. It is mentioned already in the Talmud under the rubric of a greater issue, a broader issue, called in Hebrew Ha'arama, or Ha'arama, as it's pronounced more quickly. And you know, what is Ha'arama?
Which was that?
It comes up in a few. We're going to see it in Beza, among others. Well, trickery. Ha'arama is trickery. It's the use of a clever approach in order to avoid the impact of a law. The sages took this very, very seriously and instituted penalties to avoid people trying to engage in ha'arama in a broad area of law, and they took it even more seriously than intentional violation of the law. And the example I'm going to give first is not from taxes, but from a completely different law, which requires a couple of seconds of explanation. And this is the law of Eruv Tavshilin. Essentially, the rule is that even though I'm allowed to cook on Yom Tov, on a holiday, I'm not allowed to cook for the sake of the next day. Okay? Imagine today were Shavuot, right? Today's Wednesday, we're Shavuot. I would not be allowed to cook on Shavuot for the sake of Thursday. I'm allowed to cook for the sake of a holiday meal, a Yom Tov meal. But the question arises, what if the next day is Shabbos? What if Friday is my holiday, Shabbos is the next day, and I want to cook in order to have a nice meal for Shabbos, because on Shabbos I can't cook at all. So without going into the ins and outs of what was prohibited biblically, rabbinically, and so on, it's a nice discussion in its own right, the answer is that you create what's called an Eruv Tavshilin. And what you do is you start cooking for Shabbos on Thursday, or on Wednesday, depending on how your holiday falls out. Again, beyond the scope of what we need to discuss. But the point is that before Yom Tov, before the holiday, you begin your cooking for Shabbos, you put the food aside and say, this is going to be for Shabbos, and you say, now that I did that, I am also allowed to cook on Yom Tov for Shabbos. And that way, you preserve the honor of the Yom Tov, and you also make sure that there's going to be food for Shabbos. That's, again, without getting into the specifics of the law. But the question becomes, that's all well and good if you remembered to make this Eruv Tavshilin. What if you forgot? And now it's already Yom Tov. Are you now out of luck? You have no food for Shabbos. So there is an idea, which you know, you're probably familiar with, that the rabbi of the community creates an Eruv Tavshilin and has people in mind and says this will be for them also in the event that they forgot. And that works if somebody forgets once. You can't keep on relying on that. But the Gemara here discusses the case in which somebody forgot to make the Eruv Tavshilin. And it says, I'm in source number three, and I'm jumping down to the fourth line, middle of fourth line in the English. I always bring the Hebrew because I want people to have it, but I'm going to read out of the English in the interests of time. It's talking about somebody who does not have an Eruv Tavshilin, and the case that they're giving is actually somebody who made the Eruv Tavshilin, but ate it too early. He ate it during the holiday. And if you eat it at that point, it doesn't work anymore. Now you can't cook. So what it says in the middle of the line, the fourth line in number three, he may only cook for the holiday and then save any remainder for Shabbat. So what you can do, you're stuck. It's now Yom Tov. You ate your Eruv Tavshilin already. What do? So cook for the holiday. And if there's something left, so you'll have it for Shabbos. That's the solution. But you're not allowed to play a trick. In the words I underlined, if he plays a trick, the food is prohibited. Meaning, if he says, oh, I'm cooking this for the holiday, but everybody can see it's Shabbos food, He's living home alone, and he cooks this, you know, great big meal, and we know he has no guests showing up, so at that point the food is prohibited. And the Talmud asks a question. The question that it asks is this. We began the source. I jumped in the middle of it. The source began by asking, what if somebody doesn't have an Erev Tavshilin and they violate Yom Tov, they cook for Shabbos intentionally? And they say, well, we've learned that if you ate your Erev Tavshilin, and you then cook for Shabbos playing a trick, the food is prohibited. So ostensibly that should mean that if I do this intentionally and overtly, it's also not allowed. I have a feeling that I could have worded that more clearly. We want to know what happens if you violate the law intentionally. Is the food permitted? And we try to bring proof by saying, well, if you violate it with a trick, you're not allowed to use the food. So then certainly if you violate it intentionally, you also should not be allowed to use the food. But the Talmud concludes it's not so. Rav Ashi said, you are talking about a trick. Tricks are different. For there the sages are more strict than they are regarding intentional violation. In other words, it's theoretically possible that if you break the law intentionally, we'll let you get away with it. However, if you break the law as a way of playing a trick and pretending that you're really doing right, then we're actually going to come down harder on you. Why would we come down harder on the person who played a game than on the person who broke the law overtly?
You're lying.
Okay, we don't like lying.
No, because you're burning the lines. It's simply a slope.
Well, the other guy did it intentionally. He didn't need a slope.
But that's the whole thing. Everyone knows it was done intentionally, whereas here you're only blurring the lines. People don't know whether it's...
Ah, so it starts to blur the lines about what is allowed and what is not. Take a look at source number 4. Rabbeinu Nisim, writing in the 14th century, offers us two explanations. He says, first of all, if one acts intentionally, he violates the words of the sages, and none will learn from him. They consider him a sinner. In other words, everybody knows what you did was wrong. Sometimes, he may even contemplate fulfilling the mitzvah of Eruv. He says further, maybe this guy at some point will feel bad and say, you know what, I want to do things right in the future. So you have two features. Number one, with the intentional violator, everybody knows it's wrong. And number two, he might repent one day. But one who plays a trick, thinks he's acting permissibly, he thinks that idea was fine. He'll never decide to repent, and people will learn from him, and the law of Eruv will be uprooted. Therefore, the sages fined him and said, you don't get to eat the food that you made.
Why does he think he's acting permissibly when he knows he's tricking?
Because he was told, make the food and just declare that it's for Shabbos, for Yom Tov. Declare that it's for your guests, and he thinks that what he's doing is within the letter of the law, not recognizing that it isn't just a formula that you say, well, this is for guests. There has to be some possibility, you know, that someone's gonna show up. And so, Jewish law tries to close loopholes when it comes to taxes, and tries to avoid having people make use of tax avoidance methods. And here I'll get into one example of it in terms of taxes. We've already mentioned a few times that there is such a thing as an agricultural tithe. I have produce, I'm obligated to tithe it. At what stage am I obligated to tithe the produce? When does my obligation kick in?
You've got to sweep the house, remember?
Gershon already is cutting
that's
to the
how,
chase.
That's how I'm up on the kingdom. I've got around it. I bring it through the roof.
Possibly. Possibly. The basic rule, before I get to your particular application of it, is that only once the processing is complete, to a certain stage, does the obligation begin. So for example, I'm a harvester working out in the field, and I pick grapes, and I decide I'd like to eat some. So first of all, the biblical law requires the owner of the vineyard to allow me to take grapes. I'm not allowed to bring along a doggy bag and say I'd like to pick some grapes, put them in the bag, and take home for myself. But I'm hungry out there in the vineyard, I'm working for him all day, I am allowed to take grapes for myself and eat them. And I have no obligation to tithe the grapes. No obligation whatsoever. The obligation only begins once the processing of the grapes reaches a certain stage. And one of the rules, as Gershon says, is that when I bring it into my house, but specifically, it goes through the front yard. That's when I become obligated to tithe it. So, a good means of tax avoidance is bring it through the skylight. Window, the skylight, the back, whatever. So take a look at source number 5, in which the sages of the Talmud observe, come and see the difference between earlier generations and later generations. And you know when you start that way that the earlier generations are going to be better. This is about the good old days. Earlier generations brought in their produce via the foyer in order to obligate it in tithes. Later generations bring in their produce via roofs and yards in order to exempt them from tithes. It used to be that people went out of their way to obligate themselves. They were going to fulfill the mitzvah, and now they actually do the opposite. So the phenomenon of tax avoidance exists within Judaism going way, way back. And yeah, absolutely. And yet, the loophole exists. Right? Fundamentally, the loophole does exist. And not only does the loophole exist, but take a look at source number 6, which is a Mishnah. So you're talking about a text that's going back now a couple of thousand years regarding the secondary tithe, the Meister Sheni. And this requires a little bit more explanation, but should be relatively straightforward. This is the tithe which, in certain years, you take 10% of your produce, assuming you were dealing with Israeli produce. So you take 10% of your produce and you bring it to Jerusalem. There's a problem with that. What if I have this massive field, right? I'm growing, fill in the blank, whatever it is, anything, it doesn't make a difference. And I live in Afula, or I live in Haifa, or wherever, somewhere that is not around the corner from Jerusalem. I have to pack everything up on, you know, a whole string of animals. I make a caravan in order to bring it to Jerusalem. How in the world is that going to happen? So the answer is, you redeem it. Correct. You redeem it for cash. And you bring the cash to Jerusalem. However, if you redeem your own tithe, as opposed to redeeming somebody else's, if you redeem your own tithe, then the rule is that you have to add, we call it 20%, that's its own discussion, is it 20 or 25, not the point right now, but you have to add 20% to its value when you do the redemption. That's a fine. Because we don't want people redeeming it and then bringing the cash to Jerusalem and buying food there, because one of the benefits of this mitzvah is that the markets of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem, will be filled with produce. You want fresh produce there. If everybody just redeems it for cash, brings the cash to Yerushalayim, then you don't have produce, fresh produce, on the market. So therefore, there's a fine of this percentage that we add when you redeem your own. Well, it's fairly easy to think of a way around it, right? What do you do? How would you get around this? We have accountants in the room.
Give it to your kids.
Giving away the produce won't help you. No matter how they received it, it's a problem still.
Sell the low value.
Take a look at source number 6. One who redeems his secondary tithe adds 20%, whether he grew it or it was given to him as a gift. So giving away the produce to somebody else isn't going to help, because they have the same obligation. However, he says, they may make a trick regarding the secondary tithe. How? One tells his adult son or daughter or Jewish servant, here is money, redeem the secondary tithe. You give somebody you trust the cash, and they will do the redemption of your tithe. You follow? Giving away the tithe doesn't work. But I can give them the cash to redeem it. It's not their produce, so they can redeem it without the added fine. And then they or I, whoever, can take the money to Jerusalem and use it to buy food there. And the language that's used in the Mishnah, if you can read the Hebrew, you're better off. Ma'arim en al-ma'aser sheni says, you are allowed to do this. The loophole exists. And so here's the question. You told me when it came to the Erev Tavshilin that you didn't like loopholes, and you're going to punish people who inappropriately take advantage of them. And here, in the Mishnah, you are telling people, here's how you get around the law. Right? You're explicitly telling people, and there's no penalty for it, and there's no institution to avoid people taking advantage of it. How do we understand this? So Maimonides writes in source number 7 in his commentary to a Mishnah in Temura, he says something which doesn't solve the problem at all. His answer is, it's a matter of language. He says, permissible tactics are called ha'arama. That which is not permitted is called mirma. He says there are two different terms. Ha'arama comes from the word orma. To be arum means to be clever. Mirma means to be deceitful. Ramaut is deception. two different words, although they share some letters and it makes it sound similar. There's a difference between being clever and being deceitful. The reason I say that that doesn't really explain anything is because one man's cleverness is another man's deception. Right? I mean, really, all he has done is point out that there's what I'm going to say about what I do and what I'm going to say about what you do. Right? What I do is ha'arama. That's clever. What you do is mirma. That's deception. That's essentially my my definition of the difference between the two. How in the world can you do that? Not to mention his terminology is not precise. The commentators on the Mishnah, Tosfos Yom Tov, Tiferes Yisrael, they note that his distinction of what's called ha'arama and what's called mirma, that one is good and one is not good, actually doesn't carry through in all cases in the Mishnah. So we need something better than to say some are okay and some are not okay. And there are two different approaches that I want to offer you. The first approach is that where it is for the sake of a greater ethical good, then it is justified. Where you are doing the ha'arama for the sake of accomplishing a greater good, then we're okay with the ha'arama. So, for example, take a look at source number 8. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. Probably the last name people would think of from the last few hundred years as somebody who's going to justify a leniency that's going to allow you to subvert the law. Look at what he says. He says, I have to give you a little bit of context, I think, in order for this to make full sense. But he says, talking about Maser Sheni, he's talking about the secondary tithe case and the ha'arama that one is going to engage in. He says, I'm actually going to jump to the middle of the first line. That's probably the easiest way to do it. Deuteronomy 14:24, that's the verse that talks about redeeming it when you can't carry it to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem. He says, when you cannot carry it, when you can't transport it, at that point you redeem it. And the verse concludes, for God will bless you. When you do this, God is going to bless you when you redeem it and bring the money to Jerusalem. Because people needed to add 20%, they declined to redeem it. They only brought the produce, losing the blessing. Therefore, the sages made a permissible trick available to redeem without 20% and bring the money. It still requires explanation outside the text. So what he's saying is this. In the event that you don't allow people the trick, you just tell people either you bring the produce or pay extra. The result is people are not going to redeem it because they know redeeming it costs more. And they're also not going to bring the produce either. They're going to say, well, bringing the produce, I can't do that. That's my only option. Forget it. I'm out. And the result is that they lose the blessing that's promised in the biblical verse, which says that when you do this, God is going to bless you. You follow? You see what he's saying? He's saying that the biblical text says you should bring the food or you should redeem it. And when you do that, God is going to give you a blessing. They're going to lose out now by not doing the mitzvah. So since your alternative is that people are not going to perform the mitzvah, better to have them use what is a deceptive method, essentially. They're giving the cash to somebody else, and that person will now do the redemption. Better to do that, and have people perform the basic mitzvah, which they are doing. They're just getting around the 20% fine on it. You follow? That's the idea. It depends on what our choices are. If my choice is, use this ha'arama, or not do the mitzvah, better to use the ha'arama. An example of that also is seen in Professor Urbach in source number 9. He writes, it would appear that evasion of the payment of the one-fifth was widespread, and the sages realized that insistence on their part on the strict observance of the law could very well lead to the populace refraining altogether from bringing the redemption money to Jerusalem. The halachic sanction they gave to the practice of evasion was, in a sense, a takana, an enactment, to prevent the development of a situation in which, quote, the people refrained from bringing, similar to that in which the people refrained from lending, which led to the takana of the Prose Bowl, which Hillel adopted. And that's another ideal example. You know that the law says that every 7 years, loans are supposed to be forgiven. Meaning, any loan which was already due before the seventh year, or before the end of the seventh year, and was not paid back, is supposed to be forgiven. The sages saw that people were not doing this. People were not forgiving the debts. The sage Hillel came up with a solution. there is a loophole built into that law, which says that even though an individual is not allowed to collect a debt after the seventh year, an institution is allowed to, such as a rabbinical court. And so Hillel created a document with which people could assign their debts to the court for collection. Even though the court is never going to collect it, it's really you who are going to go collect it, nonetheless, Hillel does it. Why does he do it? Explains the Talmud. Because Hillel sees that people aren't lending. And there's a separate biblical mitzvah. There's a separate biblical mitzvah which states that in the event that, which states that you're not allowed to refrain from lending as the sabbatical year approaches. So Hillel says, we can leave things at the status quo if we like. In which case, people aren't going to lend and they're going to violate biblical law by refusing to lend. Remember that lending in the context of the Torah is an act of tzedakah, is an act of philanthropy. So he says, we can do that, we can leave it that way, or we can take a loophole that's built into the law, and we can make use of it in order to serve this greater good, and now people will lend. So Professor Orbach makes the suggestion, and I think he's right, that this is meant to serve the greater good. That's what we're trying to accomplish. Yeah.
But isn't with the Meister Sheni, isn't there's a personal obligation on the person, a binding personal obligation once you have the produce?
Yes.
And then, you know, why? I mean, isn't that enough? Why do they need encouragement? Whereas with lending to somebody, I mean, somebody else could lend to them. Is it as much of a binding personal obligation?
It's not a matter of that. You're right, except I should have made this point more clear. I have a third way when it comes to this produce. I'm a farmer. I have all these grapes. I can't bring these grapes to Jerusalem. It's not going to happen. So you tell me I should redeem them for cash. Take the cash to Jerusalem. I say, well, how much is it going to cost me? And you say, value of the grapes plus 20%. I say, thanks, but no thanks. You know what I do? I take the same grapes that I could have brought to Jerusalem, I leave them out next to the vineyard, and they go bad. End of obligation. I have broken no laws. That would be the alternative for what they were doing. They wouldn't bring the produce to Jerusalem. They wouldn't eat the produce illegally. They just say, so let it go bad. It's not my problem. And they've broken no laws. So what you're doing is you're creating an incentive by subverting the fine. I should have made that point more clear before. Thank you for asking.
Can you say that passive acting laws in the Bantashis?
Yeah, it's wasteful, and I say my 20% is wasteful also. You know? I mean, waste is also in the eye of the beholder. Now, the truth is that some object to this explanation, that it was a reluctant concession in order to get people to do good. If you take a look at source number 10, the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, the sister Talmud to the Babylonian, without going into the whole discussion of where it comes from, says they used to have problems using this trick. Right? You know what the problem is when you do this trick. I walk up to my friend, right? I don't have any my kids don't really understand the whole redeeming of tithes yet, or they're minors and don't have a servant around. So I walk up to Brian and I say, Brian, do me a favor. I have all this produce to redeem. Can you take my cash and redeem the produce? And Brian says, sure. And I hand him the cash and he says, see you later. Right? I mean, you know that you're, that's why they said do it with your children, do it with, you know, someone who you can trust. That's also true. That doesn't always work out. But to take a look at source number 10, where the Talmud actually records, initially they did this with money, but then the other person would just take the money and flee. So they enacted to do it with produce. They said, give the person produce. Assign him ownership of your produce, which is harder to take and run away with. And the other would still take it and eat it. So then they enacted to assign to the other 10% of his land. What they did was, the sages said, you know what? You can redeem it using land. If you assign him ownership of a chunk of your land to use in the redemption process, he's not going to run away with your land. He can't do that. And that way you avoid problems. But what's interesting here is they enacted, the sages themselves created ways to do this. This harama, to do the trick. So some say that sounds awfully supportive for a reluctant thing. You know, now you're taking extra steps to make this work. But I still think that this is probably an accurate representation of what was going on. You know what it's like? It's like we see amnesties all the time in secular law. Right? You have tax amnesties, you have speeding ticket amnesties, you have gun amnesties, right? You give in your gun, we won't prosecute, we won't anything. Why? Because society recognizes that there's a greater good that is going to be met. And And we're better off overlooking what you did in this thing in order to serve the greater good. In this case, we will achieve the goal of having people support the needy, or in this case, bring produce to Jerusalem, if we allow for the trick. The argument to apply to tax avoidance, we'll come back to in a moment. But we still have to see a second justification. The second justification is where the Torah's own laws create incidental collateral damage. And what I mean by that is best seen in source number 11. Alana Stein wrote her doctoral paper on tricks, rabbinic tricks, essentially. It's called Rabbinic Legal Loopholes for Columbia University. And look at this piece from her paper. She says, in fact, this dodge is quite reasonable in light, it should say in light of, a post-temple reality. And what she means is, I'm actually going to say it outside looking at this, it's better for me to say it outside. What do you do after the destruction of the temple with the produce that's supposed to go to Jerusalem? So the rule is, redeem it for cash and hold the cash. You can't bring the cash to Jerusalem and buy food and eat it. That's not allowed. You're not allowed to use the cash for other purposes. It's now dedicated for this purpose. So you are now stuck. Which means the law is requiring you to redeem the produce, add 20%, and then just freeze the money. So what she argues, and I think there are reasons that you could argue with this in terms of technicalities of the redemption process, but I think that overall it's a valid point and has other applications. The hit you were supposed to take was you're going to have to spend more money in Jerusalem. At the end of the day, you get to keep the money. Meaning, even if I'm paying extra to redeem it, I'm taking that money to Jerusalem and buying food. I have a nice vacation. However, because the temple is destroyed, now that money's getting burned. I can't use the money at all. God willing, tomorrow it's rebuilt. But right now my assets are frozen. And so because of that, they said, at least let's relieve the fine and give them a workaround. You follow the idea? At least this way, you avoid an incidental hit, which wasn't built into the law. It wasn't supposed to happen. This freeze of your assets should not have happened, and that's why it motivates us to allow you to get around it. I'll give you another example of it. I'm cutting a little bit here in the interests of time because we got the late start. But take a look at number 12. But it requires some explanation first. There is a rule that I'm not allowed to salt an animal hide on Shabbos or Yom Tov. Right? Salting a hide is an act of tanning the leather. And that's not, by the way, before I forget, I'm sorry, I didn't pass around the sign-in sheet. If you want to be able to get a link to the audio as well as the source sheets for these monthly classes in advance, make sure that you sign in. If you already received this source sheet in advance, it means that you're already on my list and you don't have to enter your email address. Thank you. The case is as follows. I'm not allowed to salt a hide. It's part of a tanning process. On Shabbos, I'm not allowed to do it on holidays either. What about the following case? I need a Yom Tov meal. I want to have meat for my Yom Tov meal. I don't have any fresh meat available because we're now going back 2,000 years and the refrigerator isn't working because there's no power company. Right? So what do? On Yom Tov itself, I shecht an animal. That's what you did. They would shecht on Yom Tov itself, distributed among people in the community, and that's the way you had fresh meat for the holiday. By doing that, though, you lose the hide. Because if you're going to wait until the holiday is over to salt the hide, to preserve it, it's already going to shrivel up. It's not going to be as good. You follow the problem? So what they allow you to do is another trick. While there is still some meat on the hide, pour a lot of salt on the meat that's on the hide. You're salting the meat, which you're planning on eating. And by the way, the hide will also benefit from the salting. So once again, isn't that a trick? So the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, in source number 12, says this is allowed only where the loss is due to celebration of the holiday, not carelessness. We're going to allow it because fundamentally, he's losing out. The prohibition against salting a hide on Yom Tov was never meant to punish people for having meat for their Yom Tov meal. It was meant to be, we don't want you salting a hide on Yom Tov. So therefore, you would lose out because you did a mitzvah, that's effectively what happens, then we're going to allow the trick. So the key is that where the law itself incurs an incidental hardship due to extraneous circumstances, such as today is a holiday, and I had to make food for the holiday, or such as the previous case we gave, the temple is destroyed and now I'm not able to use the money that I redeemed it with, that's when we're going to say that that you're justified. So what that means is I have two different justifications, and now we have to take it back to tax avoidance. But one justification is the greater good for the system. The other is to avoid an incidental penalty, something that is collateral hardship due to extraneous circumstances. So if the justification for tax avoidance is that it serves a greater ethical good, such as it makes tax payment manageable. People aren't able to pay the full thing, so they're going to structure their businesses such that they're able to avoid the tax hit. That would be a hypothetical justification that we would be willing to accept. If let's say society says it's beneficial for us to have charities that are supported, and therefore we're going to allow you, in this case it's part of the law, but we're going to look the other way and we'll call it tax avoidance when people are going to give to charity rather than use it for themselves. And that way, the charities, the nonprofits, will be supported. That would again be something that would be acceptable because you're serving what we recognize as a greater good. As opposed to where it's to fill your own pocket, to make yourself wealthier, that's when we're going to have a greater issue. Similarly, if the justification for the tax avoidance is that the law itself creates an incidental collateral hardship, then avoidance would be justified. I can't really think of an example within the tax law where the law itself creates a problem because of an extraneous circumstance. All the problems the law creates seem to be very direct.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Probably at least 75% of this room here makes them for some time.
Yeah.
Very often there are negotiations with the restaurant or the caterer or the band. I'll pay you on the schwarz, you know. Well, I'll give you a certain amount and we'll avoid the 13%. And
I hope not.
Well, or you find people.
I understand what you are alleging, while that accepting the allegation.
So from two here. I myself, well, I'm admitting fault.
See, no, the truth of the matter is that what Gershon is describing is a widespread practice within society, the cash business, that sort of thing. Actually, I went to the barber. I think I mentioned this at the last one, though, if you did this. I don't remember if I did or didn't. But I went to the barber and asked him, you know, why don't you take credit cards? I had never seen a barber take credit cards. And he said, because this way we don't have to report it. That's another story, but it wasn't what he said. He didn't say because of the X percent you have to give to the credit card company. He said it's because this way I don't have to report it. I can't find a barber who's going to take a credit card. So
credit card. It's just pay cash. I know people wanting to take credit.
That's what we were both talking about. We said last time, from the Jewish system, it's very clear. The original statement in Jewish law that dina d'machus adina, that the law of the land is the law, is in the context of taxation. I don't get to avoid the tax by saying, well, you know, that's them and I can avoid it. It's simply not correct. Yeah.
I just have a question about that because that, to me, that seems like actual speaker of our discussion.
Yeah.
Yes, which is that I did hear. I went to talk by Rabbi Miller about 10 years ago.
You know, you are being recorded. I just want to make sure that you know that.
Okay. Thanks. I have the Moses Adina, and you know, he well since it's being recorded, I should. Qualified, you know, he was very qualified. You know, there is an issue with, with discrimination in violation of international law, right? We have, you know, Ontario discriminates against Jews in open violation of international law, and it has very, with respect to Jewish education, with respect to education funding, and it has very very severe financial consequences for the community. And under those circumstances, my understanding coming out of that talk was that it was arguably permissible to take measures, to take self-help measures to avoid being adversely affected.
Interesting. Okay, so let me speak to this a little bit because it's a point that's worth speaking to. In the context in which the Talmud says the law of the land is the law, Bava Kama Kuf Yud Gimel, which talks about the taxes, it also says that where a tax is levied in an unjust way, so the classic example in the Gemara there is you have somebody who rents the right to collect taxes from the government. He pays, you know, the government can expect to raise $5 billion if they bother doing it, but it's going to cost them $3 billion to do it. So he comes along and says to the government, I'm going to pay you $3 billion. So you make more this way, and let me collect the taxes, and then he decides to do whatever he wants. His friends pay less, the others pay more, he doesn't like Jews, so they're going to have to pay more. That's a case in which the Talmud says you are justified because he's nothing more than a thief. So what it sounds like he was arguing in the shir you attended is that since there are all sorts of, since the Catholic schools are receiving benefits that the Jewish schools are not, that's discriminatory, and that makes their tax potentially illegal. That's what you're...
Well, you know, there was a case that went to the UN. It was found to be in violation of international law.
So his argument is that that means the entire system then can be flouted. That's what it sounds like he's saying. I find that a very interesting extension. I want to discuss it with him directly because I'm curious about his thinking on this, because I don't see that cheating me on one area, assuming that it is cheating, we follow the UN, because we don't like the UN on many other things. We decided the UN is our friend when it comes to this issue.
International law.
Yeah, we don't like that either when it disagrees with us.
Could you also say that?
No, I want to make sure to address the point. I think that is an interesting argument. I want to think about it and research it in terms of your ability to then reject all taxes, because one... Or not one, even if not a tax, but because the because they're not funding the school. I think that's a very interesting premise, but I'm not sure that I understand that it's correct. The other point, though,
what goes to the fairness of the whole system?
Right. No. The other point, though, that I want to make, because we talked about the question of paying in cash, and there's a really important distinction to be made in this regard. Paying cash in order to avoid a tax hit is not tax avoidance. That's tax evasion, right? Going back to the distinction we made in the beginning. Meaning, the tax avoidance is I structure my business dealings in such a way that the law won't obligate me to do anything. Where I pay somebody for a service, and there's a requirement of paying sales tax, for me to not do so and just, you know, do it in a way that they won't know, that's actually tax evasion. That's a whole other, that's the Dina de Machusa question and so on. As opposed to tax avoidance, where the question is, well, the law doesn't actually apply. Do I need to put myself into a framework of being obligated to do this?
Is it the person paying or the person collecting?
So that's one of the issues that comes up in this regard, is if I know, you know, someone comes to my house, a plumber comes to my house, and he says it's going to be $150, nice round number, and he says, but you have to pay me cash. I can only take cash. So I know full well that it's a nice round number because he's not adding any taxes to it, and that's why he wants it to be in cash, and that way he doesn't have to report it and so on. So there is room to argue that's not my problem. There's room to argue that he asked me for cash, I'm not obligated to go any further with it. The question is the concept of lifnei iver, am I putting a stumbling block in his way by facilitating this with my cash? I've heard it argued both ways. I've heard it argued that you're allowed to just give him the cash and be done with it. I've heard it argued that you're not allowed to. I've heard the argument both ways. I think the argument that you're not responsible is probably more compelling, but it requires its own discussion.
But isn't it either? I mean, is an either somebody who doesn't already...
That's another hour at the minimum to discuss the application to that case.
It's right up a whole new topic for next time.
Yeah, it potentially is. The only question is, do I want to do it? And will people want to hear it?
If you need a plumber, you might never be able to get it.
Well, that's like barber case. I just have really long hair, and I don't have an issue.
Okay, but what happens though? The state gives a certain amount of money, never, to the PLO. Well, I'm saying that the taxes I pay goes towards the avera of.
So that goes back to the question that we asked in the beginning. What if I don't like the way they use the money? But that was the one that I specifically prefaced by saying it's not going to fit within the framework. It's a good question. The question of supporting a government that's going to use the money in a way that not only do I not like, but that I actually believe is wrong, is a major question. It's not simple and straightforward. And that may fit into as well the discussion of what one may and may not do. But the but in terms of what we're saying here, what I hope emerges from the conversation is that the issue of tax avoidance is not new. Within Judaism, it's something that's actually very old, and that there was support for it, and even rabbinic enactments were made that enabled it, going back, you know, to the times of the Talmud itself. The justification seems to be that even though we don't like loopholes and we're afraid of the impact of loopholes in other areas, and we talked about being stricter with loopholes than we are with intentional violation of sin. Nonetheless, the one justification is using an existing loophole, so it's not evasion, but it's avoidance. Using an existing loophole to serve the greater good, such as enabling people to lend, or making sure that they'll have, or making sure that they will redeem their produce. That's one. And then the other justification is where there's some separate damage that's going on by observing the law, which wasn't foreseen as part of the original law, like the temple is destroyed and now your assets are frozen, or where you're going to get meat for Yom Tov and the result is that you're going to lose the hide, so that again, it may be justified, and I think those have application within the realm of tax avoidance, where one avoids the tax in order to be able to pay. So you say, so I'll structure my dealings so that the tax burden will be less. That will be an application of it. Clearly, this requires greater discussion in terms of particular cases, but I hope that this offers some sense of the principles involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.